obsession number 27192, Reel 2.
Major Hingston, Reel 2. How did you get on with the commanding officer of the battalion?
Very well. George Taylor and I remained friends as long as George was alive. he was a thruster, and his tactical appreciation was very sound. I mean, a man doesn't get a double DSO for nothing. But there's, if I may criticize, because I think it would be useful, there was one fault he had, and that was in giving out his orders. He would finish his orders, giving one, say, 25 minutes to get back to company and get to the start time, give out your orders, which was enough. But then he would say, any questions? And then we came up against that feeling which people have that if you don't ask questions, you're no good. And people would ask questions for the next quarter of an hour, leaving you 10 minutes to get into your car, get back to your company, get them to the start line, give out your orders. About all you could do is say, we've got to attack that hill, follow me, you buggers, and hope for the best, which, of course, didn't do any good. This business of any questions, of course you've got to ask if there are any questions, but there is that very big snag in it that people will ask questions just to show how clever they are to think of something. And then you're cutting down the order time for the companies. It also meant, of course, platoon commands hadn't got a moment. They didn't get over there, you perishers, and that was it. He is the thruster. He would not put in an attack ever. I've heard him several times say he wouldn't, unless he had adequate support, which was very comforting for the company commanders. I think the only failure the battalion ever had was Tiger Hill. Otherwise, we always pulled it off. The next thing, as I remember it, was Cule Le Patris Per, I think. C-U-L-E-Y. Cule Le Patris. As I remember it. Probably got it wrong. There we came down from the village, or through the village of Cule Le Patris, down a long spur with the road running along our line of advance to a German rearguard. D Company did a left flanker in, which was completely successful and got the wiped out the front line of the German defense. Then, using a sunken road to the right, C Company brought in a right hook, as it were, and cleared them out of an orchard there. And I had to advance through to take them out of the out of a farmstead, which was more or less their headquarters. It was, I imagine it was about company strength. It was maybe two company strengths was the German strength there. And both D and C companies had dealt them a very nasty crack. They were busy getting out of the farmstead when I arrived, and they went even faster when they saw that I was arriving.
How did you go about attacking the farm? So did you just rush it, or did you go round the side?
In Normandy, you had, all that part of the world, you had Devon hedges, which was a stone wall going up so high with a hedge on top of it. Now, to climb over it was a lengthy procedure, quite enough for anybody to give you five rounds rapid. And so you had to go through the gates. So what you did was you plastered the field with fire while you pushed a couple of sections through to something of that sort. There were lots of slit trenches everywhere. Well, half the slit trench was a firing position. The other half had a lot of timber and stuff on top of it to make it a bit shellproof. The trouble was that when you tell the men to fire at the slit trenches, they would fire at this brushwood, which of course is quite useless. So we had to try and explain to them, fire at the ground just in front of it, the bullet will go through and tickle them up, no nobody's business. It was quite sufficient. We got quite a number of surrenders that way and prisoners, and I think we probably killed or injured one or two.
Were they in the buildings as well? Had they loopholed the buildings for defence?
No, you never caught a German in a building. Never. He might have his headquarters and office in there, but he wouldn't be fighting from the building, because when you see a building, everybody fires at the building. So you're outside, if you know what's what. There was one other incident there which was interesting. I think it was next morning. Our carriers came through and advanced down the road with the object of getting to the farmstead. The leading carrier hit a landmine and was blown to buggery. Whereupon the private soldiers showed up and said, "I thought that was going to happen, sir. I saw that landmine. I thought somebody was going to hit it." I couldn't think why I cursed him round if I'm not doing something about it. But that is the sort of mentality you sometimes get. You see, the untrained reinforcement mentality. We captured a number of prisoners, many of whom were Poles, forced into the army. I remember capturing one who immediately took his belt out, showed me his rifle, showed he hadn't fired it. They had no stomach for the thing at all. They were getting some food in their bellies by joining the German army, but they didn't reckon they had to fight. And I turned one of them on to digging my slit trench, which he's very happy to do, and dug me a beautiful slit trench. I don't think there's anything very extraordinary about that thing.
Did you find that the Germans themselves generally fought well in Normandy?
No, they were like everybody else. There were one or two who fought extremely well, with great determination and courage, and others who were only too willing to say, "I've had enough, chum, let's get it over and I'm surrendering." You had all sorts, as you get with any army. I mean, my own company, but those I knew would fight absolutely to the last man in the last round. I knew, and there was one fellow, I remember, I won't tell you his name, who ran away in every single action. I finally got round saying, "Look, if you do that again, my lad, you're getting a straight bullet from me." I don't think he believed me, but I got hit in that action, so it wasn't him. But you've got all sorts.
Have you got any idea of the rough proportions of those who were natural fighters who you could rely upon and those who couldn't take it, no matter how hard you could press them?
It's the old story, I think, that in any show you come up against, there's 10 to 15% will always be good because they're naturally good, they're good men. At the bottom end, you've got the same 10 to 15% who will always be bad, either because they can't or they won't. Now, those two are incorrigible. They're always going to be that. The people who matter are the 75% in the middle, who are just waiting to see which way the cat jumps. If everybody encourages the goodies and smacks the baddies, they'll be good. And otherwise, they'll slip down. Which is a thing which every discipline they're in should remember. People who started talking about, ah, poor boy, he's never had this sort of thing to do before. That sort of thing is...
Did you maintain a strict and formal discipline in your company?
I chucked my weight around, naturally. But, you see, you were losing men, you were losing NCOs, you were losing all sorts. You had to say, you've got a nice face, put a couple of stripes up, you're an NCO. That was his training. Such a man is not normally going to be a hell of a disciplinarian, saving your presence, sir. That's the way it was. You talk over with the platoon sergeant, who are we going to replace him with? He said, well, try Snooks. He's a good chap, I think, sir. Try him. I said, right, Snooks, Lance Corporal. And might be, might not be. You see, you were at it the whole time. We were chasing in those rear guards of the German army in the Battle of the Bag. And therefore the idea was, keep at them. You were no time to sort of sit back and replace and reinforce and get your this, that and the others together. You were said, well, for God's sake, now we might get a drop of sleep tonight. Nope, you're on the advance again.
So you're keeping up the pressure on
the... pressure was being kept up, which of course was not only affecting the enemy, it was affecting our own troops as well. You see, you just had to keep bloody well going. In that connection, I think I must tell a story against myself, yes. I was working on the principle which we had developed in the Airborne of platoons being comparatively autonomous units. You would say, you go 500 yards that way, you go 300 yards that way, and they work on their own. Which, with trained troops, disciplined troops, keen troops, you're all right. But, of course, we had this load of rubbish. No, but not indeed eat that word.
Were they rubbish, or were they just men with potential who hadn't had it developed?
They hadn't had the training or the experience. You see, when you went to a depot, even late on in the war, you would find them teaching them saluting to the right in slow time.
Very useful in the field.
Field was so totally different. Mm. Also, they were subject to the Daily Mirror. Now, the Daily Mirror was a menace. They had some awfully good cartoons, about six or seven cartoons in the thing, including the famous Jane. Men would read it, and they also had a fellow who finally was a subject of a comment in the House they were bad for the morale of the troops. They would say, look at these officers, look what they're doing, disgraceful shows, they have the women, whereas our poor boys, so-and-so. Undermining the morale of the troops the whole time. Eventually, Connor was the chap's name. Connor had to be chucked out and put in the army. So what did they do? They sent him out to North Africa and they gave him the writing of the troops newspaper. I can imagine nothing worse. We said, good God, what's happened to the army? I gather he was a very brilliant journalist. In the First War, so I'm told, discipline was paramount all the way through. But in this war, oh no, you mustn't do this, you can't do that, you won't do the other. And you felt the whole time you were fighting the Daily Mirror. Whole way through. It wasn't, of course, only the Daily Mirror, there were other papers as well, but they were the notable ones, because everybody bought this paper for the various cartoons that were in it. If I may digress for a moment. In the 12th Admiralty, there was a intelligence section six strong. Now, there was a lady called Jane, who periodically, she was very well drawn, the artist was brilliant, she removed most of her clothes. So the intelligence section paid in each man a penny a day. And they were each given one day of the week, and the day on which the Jane appeared in bra and panties, she scooped the kitties. But I mean, it's just an idea of how popular it was. It wasn't only Jane, there were others as well. Where were we?
You were pressing on against the German rear guards as they were
Yes, we
back.
Were the whole time.
They were falling back to Falaise, Falaise pocket.
You were shoving them back. And I recall the great bugbear there was a place called Aulnay-sur-Odon, Aunay-sur-Odon, which were, the Germans were making a strong point of, and we had to get across the Odon. I think that was our next one, if I remember rightly. Anyway, we didn't go across at Odon, we went across somewhere further east. And it was one of the three rivers in France that I crossed on the one remaining girder of the bridge. Very heroic looking stuff, but quite easy.
How wide was the girder?
Not very. But photographed it and said, "Hero Hingston," straight away, because it wasn't, and we all did it quite easily and happily without worrying. The village was right on the river, and we crossed at night, and as I remember it, there was no resistance in the village. But the road, the bank rose steeply, considerable height, maybe a couple of hundred feet, I don't know, on the other side, and was wooded. And the road twisted up through the woods, where the Germans had at least two companies waiting for us. But there was a sort of a cycle path, went up on the right, straight up the hill. It was 6 foot wide at most. And the battalion went up there unopposed. The Germans had missed it, I don't know why, most unlike them. We debouched at the top. Behind us was a hedge and the wooded hill falling steeply down. There was a gap of less than 50 yards, and there was another hedge, and that was our front line. And so we deployed C. I was there. And there was certainly a company on the left. Whether it was A or D, I don't remember. C on the right, B in the centre, and another company on the left. I can't remember what had happened to the fourth company. I just don't remember. And there we held up, and of course dawn came up.
So you'd done this at night, this advance? Mm. You did the unopposed advance during the night?
Yes, in the dark.
Effectively, you're infiltrating behind the German position.
Behind their main position. Yeah. And messages started to come through. The Germans were only too willing to surrender those who were behind us. So I said, "Well, shall I go and collect them?" I said, "No, you're going to go for battalion." So again, we had these bloody hedges on walls, which are very difficult stuff to advance through. Anyway, so I said, "Go on, have a go and see what you can do." So I went in. And then we started to suffer. Tubby Gooch on the left was wounded, and his attack on that side came to a stop. Son Koltou was killed, and that stopped it on that side. So we got forward about one hedgerow and were sort of generally sniping away, whatever we could see. And a lot of what we couldn't see, because we very seldom saw German. there we stuck.
What sort of positions had the Germans got in these hedgerows? Did you?
They were mostly not in the hedgerows because you always fired at the hedgerow. The Germans were very clever at putting the hats on back to front. They said, we would fire the hedgerow, therefore the English would fire the hedgerow, so we won't be in hedgerows. That was their attitude. Same with houses. Anything you're likely to fire at, they weren't there. And that's one of the hardest lessons which you have to teach soldiers.
It sounds as though you were having to forget all the tactics that you had learned and the soldiers had been taught and invent new tactics as you were going along.
Yes, you did. What you had to do was you went for the hedgerow and you poked your head up above it if you thought that anybody was looking. You saw these slip trenches. You could always tell where the slip trench was because it's a pile of brushwood. Mm. And so you fired at the other side just below the lip in the hope the bullet would go through the earth and shake him up.
Yes.
No ordinary extent inside. And you sniped away like that. You got fire coming back again. So you never see where it came from. You fired it in, you thought it was a bit likely.
Could you use grenades effectively?
Hmm?
What about using grenades?
No, it was more than grenade range, and it was less than 2-inch mortar range.
Ah.
It was between the two. You see, you had these fields which were, they might have been 100 yards square.
Yes.
It was a sort of rough average. Well, it's neither one thing nor the other. Anyway, the tanks then came up the road. How they got across the river, I don't know. They started to shoot the enemy up pretty good and proper. But I had, in the meanwhile, lost my only two commanders that I'd got. I had one very, very good corporal. He was killed. So I was left with nothing that was any good, and we'd suffered quite a bit. So we sat there all day, being happily shelled, by this time, I think it's a point worth noting, the Germans had one, it must have been a medium, one gun somewhere, we never found where. Well, they used to load the shell up, and every 2.5 minutes they pushed a shell over on exactly the same range. and it pitched at a certain spot, which was just on the edge of the wood behind us. Burst went that way, so it didn't worry us very much. There was a wretched soldier there who'd chosen that spot for his slip trench. So he dug it, and the shell burst near him and filled the trench, so he dug it out again conscientiously. 2.5 minutes later, in came another, same thing happened. They never quite hit it. And then stretcher bearers, we would call, right, shell coming, you see, and they'd take cover wherever they ever took cover. And the stretcher bearers took cover with two casualties in that trench. Crammed everybody down, and he got a direct hit. That's where my one good corporal went. the Germans were in that state that they had no tanks, apparently, not for us anyway, and one gun. But the thing which the Germans were extremely good at was their mortar fire. Their mortar fire, they measured in, you know, if we got within 10 yards of a target, it's a damn good shot. They were in feet and inches. They were very, very good. And their weapon didn't look anything like as good as ours, but by God, they knew how to use it. I remember the battalion captured a mortarman's map on one occasion, and they had various positions marked out. and aiming marks and all the rest of it. And what they would do is they would be sitting down in a nice little dugout somewhere safe. They'd say, right, finish your fags, put your fags out, and we go and give them a dose on such and such a target. They would bring the mortar out, mount it on target number so and so, or physician number so and so, target number such and such on that aiming mark. Then they'd tear off 10 rounds fast, and almost before the bombs had landed, they were away. The mortar fire was extremely good, extremely well managed.
What about their artillery? You mentioned this one gun. Apart from that one gun, did they have good artillery support? No.
Artillery vanished very early on.
Yeah.
It was their mortar fire which we really didn't like. We captured more than one prisoner who said, Vasha artillery. Sehr schlecht. They loathed our artillery. The gunners with their 25 pounders were very, very good indeed. And the Germans absolutely loathed it.
What sort of response time were you getting from our artillery? If you needed a DF to come down, how long would it take?
They were very, very good. Very good. I have nothing but praise for what the artillery did. We knew our own battery, of course, very well. A story is told, one occasion, I have no reason to doubt its truth. Well, the battery was supporting us, not my company. And the word came through, DCLI are in trouble. So they redoubled their efforts and they fairly pumped the bricks over. And one gun started to overrun. And if my memory serves, a gunner will correct you on this, I think the maximum overrun permitted, maximum overrun was 2.5 inches. Well, she went back 1/2 inch, inch, inch and a half, 2 inches, and everybody was saying, watch it, watch it, watch it. And she went to 2.5. And the shoot wasn't over, so they went on shooting. She went over to 3.25, and they only stopped because the shoot was over. That was the spirit of them. And that's it. We knew our own battery. We knew them very well, and whenever we could, we had a drink together. The drink was pretty scarce. But eventually, the Worcesters, I think it was, advanced through us towards the evening, and the enemy were beginning to fall back. They wiped up the prisoners on the behind us and advanced through the position. That was the end of the battle. Come in.
Hello.
Anyway.
This was in the evening of the day when you'd started your
same
attack.
Same day where yes. We put in the dawn attack.
Yeah.
which would have been our next set? It's Tulip Patches.
Yeah. Couldn't when you were trying to get forward towards Aune, couldn't the artillery help you forward there?
Not really, because you see, we were we couldn't see where the area's small arms fire which was dealing with us. You see, the next hedgerow was only about 100 yards away. Small arms fire, while you could squirt it with Bren gun and all that sort of thing. The fellow put his head down, brought it up again later and shot you. It was awfully tough. Trained troops, yes. Untrained troops?
You were just too close to the enemy then for bringing artillery.
You were too close
down
to the enemy, and it was a matter of good trained infantrymen. I'm quite sure that if I'd had the sort of chaps who were in the regular army today behind me, they'd have dealt with the situation very, very easily. But I had reinforcements.
What about the tanks? Weren't they able to come up?
The tanks were not up there when my attack went in. They came up later, and they dealt very faithfully with a lot of positions and did them a lot of damage.
What sort of tanks were they? Were they Churchill's?
Sherman's and Honey's.
Sherman's and Honey's, yeah.
I recall